Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, where wealth strategies and investment wisdom collide, featuring your distinguished host and certified financial planner, Bart Zandbergen.
Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, a showcase for wealth strategies and investment wisdom that's essential for our evolving world. I'm your host, Bart Zandbergen. In studio today, as usual, we have Paul. Paul, it's good to see you. It's been a couple weeks.
It has. Did you have a good 4th of July and everything here?
I did, indeed. And yourself?
Quiet. That was the best yet. It was quiet.
Quiet. All right. That's not a common 4th of July, but we'll take it. And I'm also pleased and honored to have two special friends and great guests. We have Polina Shepeteryova. How was that?
Okay. That's very good. Yes.
And they're friends, but I've been working on their last name for a long time. And Philippe Shepeteryo.
Yes, you have to roll the R a little bit more.
Shepeteryo.
Close though.
Okay. Well, all right. I gave it an old college try. They are brother and sister, and they are venture capital private equity experts. Just a brief background. We're going to spend some time telling the audience how you guys got here, what you're doing, what venture capital and private equity are. But just as a matter of some introduction, you're to let the listeners know, you're both founders of Cambridge Companies SPG. Cambridge SPG is an investment firm that focuses on better-for-you consumer products, something near and dear to my heart as well. The current portfolio has over two dozen brands with over $350 million in annual revenue. Technical. All right. We're back. They are partners with actress Jennifer Gardner in organic fresh baby food, a company called Once Upon a Farm, Sarah Michelle Gellar, an organic junk-free bakery company called Foodsters, rap artist Drake and Match Bar, Jamie Foxx, Ashley Benson, Haley Steinfeld, and Jeremy Piven, and eyewear brand Privé Revaux. It's going to be a French grammar.
It means private reserve and
in French, right?
Yep. It's an eyewear brand that has higher quality than some of the major European designers.
Yeah.
But we sell it for $29.95 nationwide.
Is that right?
Yes.
And all the stars are wearing.
Wow.
So they're cool.
Wow. All right, let's get into this. It's going to be fun. So let's start with sharing with the audience exactly what is venture capital and private equity. Because there's investment banking. I think there might be some confusion between what each is.
Sure. Sure. So we're kind of a hybrid between venture capital and private equity in a sense where venture capital typically is perceived as minority investments in early stage companies, and private equity is more majority controlling interest. We're kind of in between where we're oftentimes making a minority investment, but we have some controls. So taking board seats, really being hands-on with the brands, bringing in these celebrities, bringing in new executives, retailers, other strategic capabilities to those businesses to help them scale. So I always joke, we do the work of private equity, but we get paid like the venture capitalist. So we basically invest our own money and we raise capital from other investors to invest in these deals, take a meaningful position in the company, and then use our capabilities to help create enterprise value and grow that business, and then ultimately sell that business or take it public and achieve a return.
Okay. So that's the event that the investor or yourself would get is the end game, right?
Correct.
The pot at the end of the rainbow.
Yes.
Are there typically dividends that or cash flow that's paid throughout, or is it all end game payout?
It could be. I mean, we've been in deals. It's not typical because usually in a high growth company, you're taking everything from the bottom line, putting it into growth. But we've been in deals where we weren't expecting dividends, but the deal took longer than expected. And, the company is successful, cash flowing, and that cash flow was distributed. But typically, no, there's no dividends because it's all being put, reinvested back into growth.
What's the average life cycle of your deals?
Well, it changes. So when we first kind of started out, we were looking for, 5 to 7 year holds, mm-hmm. because we were getting in very early, in companies that are below $5 million in revenue, even. Like when Once Upon a Farm, when we invested in that business, it was $400,000 annual revenue business.
Wow.
Today, it's over a $25 million business 2 years later, and next year it'll be over $40 million.
Wow.
But now, you know, I would say 80% of our investments are in companies that are 20 to 100 million in sales. So those are, call it 3 to 5 year holds versus 5 to 7 when you're getting earlier.
Yeah.
But 20-25% of our deals are still early stage where they're going to take longer. But the kind of enterprise value that we create over that period of time could be significant. So
yeah.
More upside.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. We'll talk about how I think that fits in a portfolio in a minute. But let's talk about how you guys got to where you are today. How start with how you got to this country, and then what led you to your venture capital private equity career.
So we swam from we came Delta first class in 1993.
Coach, but Delta in 93 from Moscow, Russia.
Okay.
And we landed in Orange County. My mother's whole side of the family lived here, and they petitioned for us to come. Okay. At that time, the borders were closed in Russia, but they were able to petition for us. So we just left everything behind and came here to Orange County. What a culture shock, right? From Moscow to the suburbia. But we went to school here in Orange County and never left. I don't
All right, so how did this career happen, and how does a brother and sister end up working together in this career?
Sure. Well, we both had, out of college, we both had jobs. Polina was at Capitol Records, managing bands. I was at DaVita, which is a healthcare company, on revenue operations and M&A. And then in late 2010, we heard a lot of, you know, our friends and, you know, business associates and people talking about the great deals they were getting in distressed real estate. So, you know, we heard that you could buy things for 10 cents on the dollar, for 15 cents on the dollar. There was a lot of foreclosures and REOs and bank-owned properties. There was a thing called the Basel III Act, which made it so banks can't lend out more than 92% of their deposits. Prior to that, banks could lend up to multiples of their deposits.
Which led to the recession.
Right. Right. And so these banks really needed to sell off toxic assets, so foreclosures on their books, so they can maintain that 8% liquidity ratio. So there was a lot of inventory on the market. It was distressed, and nobody was buying because everybody just lost their shirt in real estate.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember in 2010, we would, you know, be looking at a deal and talking to people in our, in our industry, in our circles about the deal. And some very experienced real estate investors would tell us, don't buy this property. Next year, it'll be worth even less. The down is still going to correct even more.
Yeah.
You know, and it was tough, but... So 2010 through 14, we bought 44 distressed real estate assets. So retail centers, apartment buildings, industrial centers on the West Coast. And then in 2015, we only bought one property. And in 2016, we only bought three. And so in that two-year period where our volume really decreased was because the types of deals, so distressed real estate was...
Just not there anymore,
no longer
right?
distressed.
Right. Yeah.
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 And prices were coming up, and then we would look at, you know, be underwriting the deal and basically see that the kind of return that is possible on the deal is significantly lower than it was in prior years. Mm-hmm. And what we did is, so we raised investment capital from other investors, from limited partners, make these acquisitions, and then we would take 20% of the profit that we would generate for those investors. And so if we were expecting to generate a lot of profit, then that 20% would be a very attractive number.
Yeah.
But as we started looking at, right, as the market recovered, we started seeing that the profit that we're going to be able to generate is going to be much lower, and then we get 20% of that smaller number. And it just, the equation started not penciling as well, because it's a lot of work, and it's, you know, really hands-on management of all these assets, whether you're leasing out a property or renovating it. I mean, it takes a lot of time and effort, and a lot of things go wrong and things need to be fixed. So, you know, having private equity background, so doing M&A and DaVita, we looked at other businesses and other sectors. And having gone to UCI, or Paul Mirage School of Business is there, we looked at a lot of food and beverage businesses because we knew that Paul Mirage made all of his money selling Hot Pockets to Nestle for $2.6 billion. So we knew that if you did it right, you could make a lot of money. But we looked at all kinds of things. So distressed companies, whether it was to buy the company, turn it around, or you know, retail businesses, beauty businesses, And then one day we got pitched a deal. And the pitch was, take a look at this company. It's competing in the $5 billion bake mix category in the U.S. that hasn't had any innovation for 50 years. This company is called Foodsters. They offer an organic, non-GMO, better-for-you bake mix and bake kits. And their competitors are Duncan Hines, Pillsbury, Betty Crocker.
Yeah.
And new generation moms, millennial moms, don't want to feed, you know, these artificial ingredients, these poisonous ingredients, glyphosate and all these things to their kids when they're cooking. So at the time, Foodsters had $1 million of sales only online, and they were entering the retail market. So very small. They had purchase orders from 24 Gelson's stores and 35 Whole Foods on the East Coast. But their projection was to get to 2,500 stores by the end of 2017, and this was mid-2016.
That's a pretty big curve.
Pretty aggressive projection.
Yeah.
And then the sweetener on the pitch was, by the way, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Sarah Michelle Gellar, is one of the co-founders. So if you go look at the deal in Santa Monica, you can meet Buffy.
Yeah.
So, of course, we were kids of the 90s.
Who wouldn't want to meet Buffy?
We just like, we need to go up there because we're going to get an amazing picture with Sarah Michelle Gellar for our social media.
Rumor has it Paul had posters of Buffy the Vampire Slayer in his
I still
room.
Do. I still do.
Well, we're fans now. So we really went to look at the deal, but really to meet Buffy.
Yeah.
And then when we got there, I mean, she was like, she didn't even have blonde hair at the time. She like dyed
like,
it brown.
Is she here? And I'm like, yeah.
I almost messed up the deal. I almost said like, you're not Sarah. I didn't say that though. Yeah. But if I did, it would have messed up the deal.
Yeah.
So we were blown away by the CEO of the company. It was Galit Libo. She still is. And she ran Inc. PR, which is a huge PR agency in LA. And she represented Sarah and Jessica Alba, who's not an investor. And Reese Witherspoon, who promotes the brand as well.
Yeah.
Greg Fleischman, who's now one of our operating partners, was the president. And he's, you know, employee number three at Kashi.
Yeah.
You know, they sold that to Kellogg. Then they did the Bare Naked Granola acquisition.
Ah.
He did the Epic Provisions, which in 2.5 years sold to General Mills for $160 million. Suja Juice, he helped take that from $1 million in 2013 to $40 million in 2015.
Yeah.
So he's an industry guy. Like, he knows his stuff.
Yeah.
So we're impressed by the team, and we thought, 2,500 stores next year from basically 50 is aggressive,
yeah.
But even if you did half, like, it wouldn't be so bad. And we thought we knew what we were doing in food and beverage. Like, we thought we knew food and beverage, but we didn't really know food and beverage like we know food and beverage now. And so we led their Series A. We set the valuation. We raised the capital. We did the deal. And then other investors came in. And instead of 2,500 stores in 2017, they got 9,000 stores.
Seriously?
They went national. They were in Forbes 4 times, cover of Entrepreneur Magazine, Martha Stewart Home Living on TV, Good Day LA, Good Morning America, just always in the media.
Wow.
And they would always name drop, well, Cambridge SPG led our round.
Yeah.
And so that gave us like this instant credibility in the industry. And so we would go to these trade shows like Natural Products Expo in Anaheim or Project Nosh in New York.
Fancy food.
Yeah. And all these companies would... Right, that we would be looking to invest in or learn about, they'd be like, oh, we know you guys. You guys are the Foodsters investors. You know, so it gave us like credibility that we're a player in the industry.
And deal flow, inside deals.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And the other VCs were in that deal, so we'd start networking with them, and they had deals. And then our next deal after that was a little company in San Diego in a garage called Once Upon a Farm. And it was started by Ari and Cassandra. So they're the original founders, and the office was actually in Cassandra's garage. And they were doing $400,000 in sales. They were in 500 stores. 85 of those stores were Target stores.
Okay.
And Target was doing a test with the company where they put refrigerated, so it's fresh baby food, so refrigerated baby food. And Target put in these coolers in 85 test stores to see if it would do well. And the plan was if it does well, it'll go national with Target. So over a 7-month period after meeting them, we kind of learned everything there's to know about baby food and met with other baby food companies and just were convinced that HPP, like high pressure pasteurization or cold pressed, baby food was going to be the next innovation in baby food. Because shelf stable was just played out. Like there's hundreds of SKUs in the baby food.
Sure.
So anyway, so in January, we funded the deal. Our initial investment was like $1.5 million. And so that was January 23rd. 2017. Then on January 24th, 2017, the next day after we funded, and it was supposed to be this $4 million round, and we were a big part of that. And all these other investors were going to come in. But the day after we funded, they lost their target test. Oh. So the buyer changed everything. So now this company, you know, lost 20% of its stores and no upside for the huge national rollout.
Yeah.
High overhead and burn rate.
Right. They just, so, and then at that time, they hired a national sales team. So their burn rate went up to $150,000 a month. So now we're looking, okay, we just invested $1.5 million. They're losing sales, and the burn rate, like, you fast forward the tape 10 months, the music stops.
Yeah.
So we really stepped it up, and we helped them finish up capital raise that round. So we oversubscribed the $4 million round by $13.8 million of capital that we could not even take in.
Yeah.
In the meantime, we were working on bringing in Jennifer Garner. It was actually between Jennifer Garner and Natalie Portman. And we weren't really sure which one, but yeah, we ended up going with Jen.
And so these were, you targeted these two, or did they have like already a reputation of being like more quote unquote healthy, or how did you pick those two?
Well, Jen definitely, because she has her own garden and she has three kids, that she would go and pick her own blueberries and do everything at home. So there was just natural synergy, and she loved the brand.
Yeah.
It was not just, you know, us poaching her. She invested in the brand.
Yeah.
And later on came on hands-on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and Natalie Portman is, so we're Russian Jews, and a lot of our limited partners are Jews.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, let's get the Natalie Portman. She's Jewish. She does everything for us, you know? And we're like, oh, we'll try. but Jen Garner was a much better fit, right? And she's also involved with Save the Children, which is a children's charity. It just, there was a lot of fit. She was going through a divorce.
It was just an organic fit.
Yeah.
So we brought Ari and Cassandra and the deal to Jen and her agent, Nicole King. And Jen fell in love with the brand. She goes, I understand this. I understand HPP. I understand cold press. Like, I'm all about this. I've been presented, you know, many opportunities in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
This is something I can get behind. Like, this works with my personal brand.
Yeah.
So she's, like, excited about it. So we're like, okay, awesome. So it goes to her business team for diligence.
Yeah.
And
our favorite word, right?
Preview.
Right.
Yeah. So 2 weeks into diligence, her business team calls and says, there's zero chance that Jen is doing this deal. Our conversations are over. Goodbye. Forget about it. Like, there's no way that Jen is doing this deal. So we're like, okay, well, what's going on? They're like, well, you have five people in a garage in San Diego.
As soon as
Jennifer Garner says anything about this brand, your website's going to crash. You won't be able to fulfill orders. You're not ready for Jen. So our response to that was, well, that's true. We're not ready for Jen today.
Yeah.
But we have this 1 year ramp up plan, and these are the things we're going to do to be ready for Jen. Yeah. So, you know, if we sign the deal now, Jen won't be actually doing anything until a year from now. And so in order to sell them on this plan, that, you know, we kind of knew what we were talking about, once upon a farm, prior to us investing, the seed investors in the company were all industry executives. So guys like John Foraker, who built Annie's Organics from $9 million to $400 million in sales, was a personal investor in the deal. Bob Craig from Food Should Taste Good, that sold for a couple hundred million. Jerry Fennard, who ran Godiva Chocolates and Avon and Mondelez, and other great people. So like Megan Bend, who was critical on the deal. So we were able to recruit John Foraker, who's in Northern California, to fly down from Davis to Beverly Hills to meet with Jennifer Garner and her people to basically say, look, I'm an investor in this company, and I'll advise them, I'll help them hire the right people and build the strategy. And, you know, so John is actually, so he's known as the grandfather of the natural products industry, because Annie's was the first, it's the biggest, it's the most widespread, it's a super success. He took it public, and then after the IPO, General Mills bought it. So just a lot of credibility in the industry. And so if you were going to bet, right, if there's a meeting between Jennifer Garner and John Foraker, you know, John being a very well-respected, you know, executive and CEO, and Jennifer Garner being an actress, who would be late to that meeting?
If I was to guess, Jen. She's an actress.
Right. Well, typical.
Yeah, that's
a nice... So Jen is on time. John ends up being... It's supposed to be a one-hour-long meeting.
Yeah.
He ends up being 30 minutes late. Not his fault. There was car troubles. Like, literally, like, the car from the airport, like, the tire blew out.
Yeah.
So he shows up to this meeting late. He's in his purple Annie's shirt with, like, the gold Annie's riding with the bunny. His hair is disheveled. And he... and... Jen Garner jumps out of her chair and runs up to him and says, I am such a huge fan of yours, which my kids grew up eating Annie's, like what you did for the, you know, food and beverage is just incredible. So she's a fan of his.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Starstruck.
And he's like, well, my daughters, you know, love 13 going on 30. Like, we're big fans of your movies.
Yeah.
And this 1 hour long meeting that's now halfway done turns into a 4 hour meeting.
Wow.
And John in this meeting is explaining like what it would take, right, to take Once Upon a Farm from this very small startup with now $4 million on the balance sheet, but right, what needs to be done to get it to that, to the organizational sophistication that could accommodate like a huge celebrity brand and actually scale and grow.
Yeah.
And I think that as he's explaining what needs to get done, he starts realizing like he could do this.
Yeah.
And so
by the end of the meeting, he was like, you know what? If you're in, I'm in. Like he sold himself on day. And they just look at each other and they're like, all right. And then just a few days later, he turned in his resignation
to General Mills.
And, you know, because he stayed on with Annie's. Yeah. And we started on this adventure with both of them coming on to Once Upon a Farm.
Yeah.
And then he starts, and his deal got signed pretty quick. The Jen deal still took quite some time.
Yeah.
Because we learned that entertainment attorneys are very difficult to deal with. Especially being like, we were like an organic baby food company at the time, and we're dealing with like entertainment lawyers, just completely like clashing, you know, on everything.
Right, right.
But so he takes the headcount from 5 people to 21 people, just starts making moves, like just executing very confidently.
Yeah.
And we're on the board, and the other board members were all looking at this, and we're just like, well, this is amazing. He's making such confident moves, and like he knows exactly what he's doing.
Now, well, at this point, I want to make sure I'm tracking. There's still 1.5 in the coffers. I mean,
no, we raised the rest.
More. Yeah, okay, there was $4 million.
Okay. I wanted to see where you were going to run out of money.
But he was spending a lot of
money.
We
were going to run out of it pretty quickly.
At that rate.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but this is the power of John, right? So he's spending a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
But so we're all wondering, well, what are we going to do another round? Who's going to come in? Is it going to take time to raise? He gets on a call. He's oversubscribed by $150 million in 45-minute phone call.
There's power.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know,
yeah.
Outside he was raising, of operations,
so, he's so on this company that was at the time less than $1 million in sales, right?
Yeah.
He raised a $10 million convertible note with a $25 million valuation cap. So 25 times revenue.
Yeah.
In 43 minutes with $150 million of interest on the $10 million position.
That they had to turn.
So everybody, General Mills, Campbell's, like other big VCs, all
big,
submitted
the companies
term sheets.
Were, okay, it wasn't individual investors. It was
big investors.
Companies.
Right, right. Yes. And he turned them all down.
Wow.
Yep.
So where is that company today?
So this year, it's on track to do about $25
million. Yeah.
So it went from less than 1 to 10 to 25, and then next year the goal is to do over 40.
Yeah, and that's that's in 2 years, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And then the valuation went from when we did the deal, like around like less than 10, to it's already turned down an offer for $250 million.
Serious?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Are you allowed to say is there a magic number that you shoot for in this? Is it an X of something at some point?
I think at this point it's not really our call.
Right. Yeah. Right? But knowing John, I mean, he has experience growing a brand over $1 billion. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's...
We're hoping that he takes it public and it goes to $1 billion or more, but who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Wow, right. Wow.
That's just a...
But that was a hands-on deal, so...
Yeah. So these
not are all of them are like that, right?
Okay, so. I was just going to go there. So we only have a couple minutes left. This goes by so fast. We actually have to have you again. I know you have so many more projects. But these are great stories, and much like the more traditional stuff that I'm more used to, not all of them are good, right? So maybe not in your world, because you guys obviously have a good eye, but there's how many bad ones before you find a good one in this arena?
I mean, we look at thousands of deals, you know,
you
but
do.
We do have a criteria and a checklist. So we look at
a lot, and then we do very little, but then out of our deals, right now we're in 26 companies, and two are not growing the way that they were supposed to go, where they're having some issues.
Okay.
Right.
And so 90%.
Yep. But most of them are humming. I mean, we try to now invest in deals 20 million to 100 million in sales, so they're kind of past that
more significant, substantial.
And then a hands-on deal once a year. So those kind of keep us up at night.
Yeah. All right. That's actually where I'm going next as we're getting close to the end. So
the children that haven't graduated high school yet, right? They're geniuses, but they haven't.
That's right. So the theme of the podcast for this last year has been, hey, what keeps you up at night? And I've asked many of my high net worth clients, and it ranges from across the board. So in your world, in your guys' lives, what keeps you up at night?
I would say it's the hands-on deal, the once-a-year hands-on deal. They're a little bit earlier stage, a few million in revenue, but under five. And, you know, we're hands-on, just like we were with Once Upon a Farm. You can imagine.
Yeah,
so
I'm sure
we're
that's,
trying to aid strategically, not just financially.
Right.
What about
Same for you, Philippe?
Yeah, I would say on these deals, the ones that are early stage, right, we go out and we raise capital, we take a big position of the company, but then the work begins, right?
Right.
Then, you know, when we go out to add value, we have so many opportunities that we bring, and some of them are very high-valued opportunities, right? Yeah. Like, it's not like the deal, the value of the deal is not like, you know, 1,000 or 10,000 or 5,000 or even 100,000. Like, the value of these deals that we're working on for the company could be worth millions of dollars, like bringing in Gen, for example, or bringing in, you know, Target distribution or a Starbucks distribution. Like, that could be, you know, tens of millions of dollars of annual revenue.
Yeah.
So it's like, and they're very difficult deals to close.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know, this is way too much. Yep. So, and someone like Jen, tell me this only if you can answer. Is someone like her, a celebrity, are they paid for their time, or are they just in the deal and they're going to get paid when
they actually invest in the deal? So they're the ones giving us the money or the company.
Right, right. So it's
they invest and promote their own investment. Yeah. So they have to really believe it.
Yeah.
It has to be organic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be. So that's the best way we do it is the celebrity actually invests and take an equity position. We could do a combination of that plus an incentive equity grant where it vests over time based on performance.
Okay.
But we don't do like paid celebrity stuff.
Yeah.
It just doesn't resonate with the consumers today.
And I don't think it's consistent with the your brand, the better for you concept, I think. I think it fits there. I thought for sure, Philippe, you were going to say, what keeps me up at night? Well, I'm getting married.
Well, I was going to say, the crow that's been living outside of my window these mornings for the past couple of weeks. I don't know where he came from.
All right, so the other question I get to the pleasure of asking is, what is your ultimate lesson learned? So in your careers as I'll call you investment professionals, what's the ultimate lesson learned?
I mean, I'll tell you, so, you know, having gone through now probably close to 70 deals since 2010 across different economic sectors as a general partner, as a limited partner, as a passive investor, as an active investor. I feel like the biggest risk is not taking a risk, because the deals that I look back in real estate and, you know, in venture, like Once Upon a Farm is going to go bankrupt. It's not one of our best deals. Yeah. We have a real estate deal that, I mean, literally until it was a 3-month deal, and every single day that deal was falling apart. It turned out to be our best deal when it finally closed. So, you know, where we really stuck it out and took a calculated risk was when we were able to realize the most upside.
Yeah.
So.
And I think also to add to that, I don't think you're ever fully equipped with all the skills that you need to be a partner or an entrepreneur. I think you have to be hungry to learn and want to absorb and adapt. So I think that's one of the greatest lessons I've learned, that we just have to constantly, you know, listen in and change our perspective sometimes.
Great. Both excellent lessons. How can people learn more about you or reach you?
CambridgeSPG.com would be first. And I mean, what else?
My Twitter handle. No. CambridgeSPG.com. We have Instagrams, Polina Chvatareva, Philip Chabotarev.
Y'all got the spelling right.
Or they can just contact you. No, just kidding.
True. But Cambridge SPG. And SPG stands for Special Projects Group.
Perfect. Great. Well, guys, it's been awesome having you on the
Thank
show.
Thank you for having us on.
Of course. Thank you. Of course. I'd actually like to do it again. I think there's so many more projects, and it's a great stories to each of them. So I want to thank everyone else who has tuned in, and we look forward to being back in the studio next week. Cheers.
Tune in next week for the latest edition of the Zandbergen Report, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Catch up on our recent shows by visiting bartzandbergen.podbean.com. The Zandbergen Report is also available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. Interested in being a featured guest on our show or have a question you'd like to hear us answer? Email podcast@bartzandbergen.com. Bart A. Zandbergen, CFP, and Letitia Burbaum, AIF, are registered investment advisors with Optivest, Inc., and registered representatives with Gramercy Securities, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advisory services are offered by Optivest, Inc., under SEC registration.
He used to pester me for a walk. Now, it's the other way around. Hoag's physicians perform more orthopedic procedures than any other hospital in Orange County. Our